All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another fabulous edition of Torah Studies. This is our weekly journey into the soul of the Torah portion, and this week we have a real treat for y'all. Tonight we talk about the drama at the splitting of the sea, and I venture to say that the story that we are about to share tonight is a story that you might not be familiar with. You like how I said that? I would venture to say that you might not be, so we have both. So we're covering all the bases. You might know it, but my guess is you might not know it. Okay, so let's recap. The Jews were slaves in Egypt for 210 years. Along comes Moses, appointed by God to redeem the Jewish people. The next thing you know, we've got our matzahs on our backs, and we're bouncing out, we're breaking out of Egypt. Okay, so what happens next is the Jewish people are traveling. They're out of Egypt, and they're going on their journey to the mountain, to Mount Sinai, eventually to the Promised Land, to the land of Israel, etc. A few days later, after the Exodus, after the Jewish people leave, after Pharaoh sends them away, Pharaoh wakes up. And Pharaoh says, metaphorically wakes up, and he says, hey, where's all the construction? Why are my buildings not being built? What's going on? It's like, I remember we moved here in 2006, end of 2006. And man, wherever you looked in the city of Atlanta, wherever you looked, there were cranes, construction. Within 2 years, those cranes were not moving. No one had money to pull them out either. They were just there, but not no building, no construction when the recession hit. Right, 2008, whatever it was, 2009. So that's like Pharaoh. Pharaoh wakes up one day after the Jews leave. We were the workforce. Where are the buildings? How come nothing's happening? Well, you let the Jews out. He's like, I don't know if I meant that. Chases after the Jews. The famous dramatic story, right? So the Jews are traveling. Unbeknownst to them, Pharaoh is chasing them. Ultimately, they are traveling toward the sea. Toward the Sea of Reeds. Pharaoh is approaching from behind. He's on their heels, Pharaoh and the Egyptians, and now the Jews are trapped. You know the phrase, between a rock and a hard place. This time it's between a sea and the Egyptian army. So what do they do? So what happens is, the Midrash says, the Talmud says, the Jewish people divided into four camps. Some said, let's go back to Egypt. Let's give up. Let's turn around and say, wave the white flag. Let's go back. Some said, can't go back. We should commit mass suicide. Throw ourselves into the sea and end it all. We can't become slaves again. Some said, let's fight to the bitter end. And some said, let's pray to God. What does God tell them to do? Hashem, God tells Moses, tell the Jewish people, don't go back, don't commit suicide, don't fight, don't even pray. Rather, what should they do? Vayisou, they should keep on moving forward. Understand what that means. Moving forward is into the sea. And yet, that's what God tells them to do. God says, move on forward. Let's open up our Chumash. Torah portion is B'shalach. Let's see some of this inside. 422, 423 in your Chumashim. Let's read this text, this beautiful text inside, where the answer to the various factions of the Jewish people is given. Take a look. Actually, top of 429. Let's skip all the way to 429. This is Moses speaking to the people. Tim, please get us started. Moses is speaking to the people, relaying the word of God.
At the top. Moshe said to the people, don't be afraid. Stand firm and seek God's salvation that he will perform for you today. You may be seeing the Egyptians today, but you will never see them again. God will fight for you, but you must remain silent.
So listen to this. He answers all four groups. Stand firm and see God's salvation is no suicide. You may be seeing the Egyptians today, but you will never see them again. Don't go back to Egypt. God will fight for you. You don't need to fight. And you must remain silent. No prayer either. You see that? All four camps are basically pushed aside with those verses, with that narrative. So what happens? Rather, continue.
Moshe stood praying to God, but God said to Moshe, "Why do you cry out to me? Speak to the children of Israel and tell them that they all have to do is travel. You should lift your staff and stretch out your hand over the sea and split it. The children of Israel will come into the sea on dry land."
So God says, "Vayiso, let them travel forth. Who told you to stop? I told you," God says. "I told you, Moses, tell the people to keep on going until you hit the mountain, Mount Sinai. So just because you came to a sea, so who says you should stop? Ah, you're going to tell me the sea is impassable, you can't get through it, we're going to drown? Who said? Keep on going, you'll see what happens." And indeed, the sea splits. But now we get to the next part of the story that's not specifically stated in the text. Who goes in first? And how does the sea split precisely? So it says Moses is supposed to lift his staff and stretch it over the sea, and that will split it. Well, is that how it happened? Not exactly. According to our tradition, it was either an entire tribe or an individual who first goes into the sea before it split, and only then, after either an individual or individuals have already gone into the sea, only then does it actually split. Sometimes we have to get in over our heads in order to see the miracles happen. That's also a lesson. But let's take a look now in our Torah studies text. All right, so open up your book or your printout to lesson number 2. Text 2 as well. You can find it on page 31. Thank you. Page 31. Text 1. We're going to go back to text 1. Page 30. Okay, Alex, please read this one.
Rabbi Meir said, "When the Israelites stood by the sea, the tribes argued with one another, each wishing to descend into the sea first. The tribe of Benjamin took the initiative and descended first into the sea. As it is stated, there is little Benjamin, their ruler. Read not Rodem, their ruler, but Red Yam, descended into the sea. Thereupon, the princes of Judah hurled stones at them, as it is stated. The princes of Judah, their council, Rigmatan, the word can also be translated as stoned them. For that reason, the righteous Benjamin was worthy to become the host of the All-Powerful, as it is said, God dwells between his shoulders. Rabbi Judah said to Rabbi Meir, that is not what happened, but each tribe was unwilling to be the first to enter the sea. Then sprang forward Nashon, the son of Amminadab."
Okay, so here we have, from the Talmud, Tractate Sota 36b, a Talmudic dispute. And by the way, this text, text 1 of this class, perfectly captures the entire Jewish experience. And why do I say that? Because look what's happening. There's two Jews, arguing over the argument that the ancient Israelites had. It's not only that the ancient Israelites had an argument, but it's that they're arguing over who had the argument and what type of argument it was. Okay, so that's, again, like a meta type of situation. What does Rabbi Meir say? First opinion. Rabbi Meir says, here's what happens. The Jews got to the sea. They were told to march forward. All the tribes were arguing which tribe should be the one to jump into the sea first. Benjamin takes the initiative and jumps in. And what happens? Judah, the tribe of Judah, starts throwing stones at them. They're in the sea. They start throwing stones at them. And as a reward for Benjamin's initiative to jump into the sea, they were granted a very special gift, that the piece of land that they would inherit in the land of Israel would be the place where the Holy Temple would ultimately be built. The Beit HaMikdash, the Holy Temple in Jerusalem, there were two of them. One lasted for 410 years. The second one for 420 years. The first one destroyed by the Babylonians. The second destroyed by the Romans in the year 69 of the Common Era. So these two temples stood, and the Temple Mount today in Jerusalem stands in the portion of the tribe of Benjamin. Why Benjamin? They were the first ones into the sea. stoned by the tribe of Judah. Now, Rabbi Yehuda says, Rabbi Judah says to Rabbi Meir, this is a nice story, but it didn't happen. How did the sea split? Who went in first? And most of us know this. Many of us know this. It was Nachshon, the son of Aminadab, from the tribe of Judah. He's the one that went in first. The water got up to his nose, and then the sea split. It wasn't Benjamin. There were no stones involved. It was Nachshon, the son of Aminadab. We're not going to focus on that second opinion. Let's focus on the first opinion. Second opinion is pretty straightforward, and we've all, many of us know it and have heard it, and that has its own lesson. But let's talk about the first opinion. Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir says, the tribe of Benjamin, all the tribes are quarreling. Who should go first? Benjamin jumps in. Judah stones them, and Benjamin gets rewarded. Do you have some questions? I know I have a lot of questions. What are your questions? I want to hear your questions.
I've never heard of it, but it sure seems strange that I've heard that a tribe would stone another tribe for being so valiant and making the path open for the rest of it.
Yeah, what's up with that? This is sour grapes. You got in before, so therefore I'm going to throw stones at you to try to slow you down. Like, what is it? What is it? Okay, good. So what's with the stoning? What else?
What was the punishment for the tribe which has
What happens to them? So Benjamin gets rewarded. What happens to Judah? We'll see that. We'll discuss that soon. Good question. What else? What other questions might you have?
Well, it was not normal punishment at the era, like when you need to punish someone back then. Like, what was a normal punishment?
We'll find out. One second. Are you saying was stoning? I don't know what it means. Were they big stones, small stones? I don't know. Yeah.
If they all argued about who was going to go in first, why didn't they all go in together?
That's a good question. You heard this question?
No.
All the tribes are arguing who should go in first. I have an idea. It's a big sea, just go in. What are you arguing about? You want to go in? Go in. It's not like there's a border, but it's not like there's a wall by the sea, right? Yeah, well, there's a shutdown anyway. There's no one working there, so there's chaos. You can go, joking, everybody, right? So you can totally just go in if you want, right? So all the tribes are arguing who should go in first. What do you mean arguing who should go in first? Just go in. What's the argument about? And Benjamin takes the initiative. What was stopping anyone else from taking the initiative yet? Yeah, what's this, like, Egyptians, give us a moment, we're having a family discussion here. Like, what's going on? Yeah.
All right, so, no, I'm cool, never mind.
You're good?
I'm just thinking about this. And
all right, while you're thinking, let's share Rashi's explanation. Because Rashi's our classic go-to commentary. He lives in the 1100s, he lives in France. There's a wine today named after him, Rashi wine. It's not that great, whatever, it's wine. All right. Honestly, Rashi wine is made in New York State from New York State grapes. So they just co-opted the name, but whatever. Anyway, Rashi is our go-to commentary for both the Torah, the Bible, and the Talmud. And this story was from the Talmud. So let's see what Rashi says. Maybe he sheds some light. Julian, would you like to read text 231? So Rashi helps explain what was the deal with the stone throwing. Why? So hold on one second before we turn the page. Why did they throw stones? Because they were jealous.
Stepping stones.
They needed so to build it up. They're like, no, we're not throwing it at you. We're throwing it for you, right? The more stones, you'll be able to walk on the stones, right? But again, what does Rashi say? Rashi says, the princes of Judah were jealous, and so they threw stones. What were they jealous of? Ostensibly, what were they jealous of?
Not being first.
So what? If you're not first, okay, listen. I was just at our preschool at IJP, InTown Jewish Preschool, this morning. They had Dad's Day or Special Persons Day or whatever they call it, and we built stuff and whatever. I'll tell you this. If a kid gets in line before another kid, and the second kid says, hey, I don't like that. I want to be first and starts throwing stones, that's going to be a problem. You can't get away with that, right? And you don't just reward the one who's ahead or placate them. There's some sort of punishment for the one who threw the stones. So what happens to Judah? Judah's what? The tribe of Judah is jealous that they throw stones. So what happens to them? Text number 3. Sorry, read what happens to Judah, please. Page 32. Keep it. Yeah, no, you're good. Yeah, that's not a typo.
What reward did the tribe of Judah receive? They merited kingship over the other tribes, as it is stated. The princes of Judah, their council, Ribmatam.
Mm-hmm.
The word Ribmatam is associated with royalty, as it is stated. Then Belshazzar ordered, and they attired Daniel with a purple and the golden chain on his neck, and they announced about him that he should rule over a third of the kingdom.
Huh. Okay, so Tosfot, in his commentary on the Talmud, says that not only was Judah the stone-throwing tribe, not only was Judah not punished, but they were actually rewarded, and rewarded with royalty. As is known, King David, the great King David, was from the house of Judah, the tribe of Judah. And his descendants were the kings. The monarchy, the Jewish monarchy for all ages, ran through or came from the tribe of Judah. So what does Tosfot say? That what happens in the aftermath? Benjamin, who's in first. Who's on first, right? Benjamin, who gets in first. They're rewarded with the place of the temple in Jerusalem, in Israel, where the temple's built. And Judah, the stone-throwing tribe, what's their reward? Monarchy, to be the kings. What? Talk about a plot twist. What happened? We were expecting a punishment. At least a timeout, right? Think about my preschool example. At least something, you know? Read the book, Stones Are Not for Throwing, right? It's not a real book, but there's a book, Teeth Are Not for Biting, which I know. But anyway, right? Don't ask me how. Anyway, so here's the question. Instead of a punishment, they're getting a reward. And a reward of the royal kingdom, the monarchy of Israel. Yeah.
I was like, in order to be a king or a politician or whatever, or anyone in power, you have to be kind of like bloodthirsty.
You need to throw some stones.
Yeah, so I feel like it's
interesting. Like, it's appropriate. You're saying it matches. Like, well, listen. We need a king who's strong and who doesn't mind a little violence. So, who's done some? Judah. They threw the stones. Judah, you're hired, right? We're gonna look at this through a much deeper lens. But that's an interesting take.
Yeah. I have a question. I don't know Torah very well, but I have a question. Was David become a king because he was a very good fighter throwing the stones?
He had a famous story with Goliath. Remember David and Goliath? Where Goliath was a mighty giant who was a Philistine giant who was antagonizing the Jewish people and challenged the entire Jewish people to a showdown. Young David, little David, great giant Goliath. So David takes a slingshot, puts in it
a stone,
and gets him right between the eyes. He falls, and that was it. He slays the giant. On a simple level, he was chosen because of his abilities as a warrior. But he was also a very pious individual. And there are stories about him that seem to present a less than stories of where he may have done things that are questionable. But according to Jewish thought, he, notwithstanding whatever he did or didn't do, he engaged in a very spiritual path of teshuva, of return, throughout his life. He was a very pious individual. So he was chosen both for the physical part as well as for the spiritual part. I will say, though, parenthetically, that the temple, the holy temple, the first temple, was designed by David but built by Solomon, his son. Why? Because God said, David, you have too much blood on your hands. The temple is a peaceful place. So even though you fought all these wars and destroyed all these enemies with good intent and for a good purpose, but nonetheless, on a practical level, you've been involved in bloodshed, and my house is going to be built by someone who's not involved in warfare. And in fact, Solomon, the name in Hebrew, Shlomo, means peace. Shlomo is related to shalom, which is peace and completion, wholeness. Anyway, but that being said, we're left with a bunch of questions. Number one, let me recap all the questions that we're going to focus on. Number one, why the quarreling? If you want to go in, go in. Number two, why the pushing in the first place? Who cares who's first? They're all going through. Number three, what's with the stone throwing of Judah? Number four, why is Judah rewarded for the stone throwing with the monarchy? So to answer all of this, we're going to continue to quote Tosfot. Remember, Tosfot is a Talmudic, one of the classic Talmudic commentaries. I mentioned before Rashi. Rashi had several daughters who were great scholars of their own right. His daughters had, in turn, sons who became known as the Bali HaTosfot. They authored their own commentary collectively. It was a compilation of various grandsons of Rashi. They compiled a commentary on the Talmud, and they addressed many of the issues that Rashi doesn't address. They address contradictions that Rashi leaves, and sometimes they disagree. In fact, famously, one of Rashi's grandsons, it's not a Talmudic debate, it's a Jewish law debate with regards to the tefillin, the phylacteries that men wear. So there's a question about the order. Well, Rashi has an opinion about the order of the scrolls in the tefillin in the boxes. And his grandson, one of his grandsons, known as Rabbeinu Tam, he had a different opinion. So us Chabadniks, many of us, we actually put on two pairs of tefillin every morning. We put on the Rashi tefillin, and we do all the prayers with that. And then we take off the Rashi tefillin, put on the Rabbeinu Tam tefillin, just say Shema and another quick short prayer, and take off the second pair. It's each pair of tefillin has the scrolls in a different order. There's four scrolls, 1, 2, 3, 4. The question is it 1, 2, 3, 4 or 1, 3, 4, 2, whatever. There's a question of the order. So the story goes that Rashi once was wearing his tefillin on his head and his arm, and he's holding his grandson, Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam swiped at his head tefillin, and Rashi later on said, I knew from that moment that he was going to disagree about something with the tefillin. Anyway. That's a legend that I've heard. I wasn't there to corroborate. It's about 1,000 years old. Now, getting back to our story. Tosfot, on the Talmud and Sota, Tosfot explains a little bit more about this story of Benjamin and Judah and going into the sea and throwing the stones and the rewards. And he gives an analogy. He gives a parable. He tells a story. And he says, the story that I'm about to tell you is going to explain what happened with Benjamin and Judah. So let's read the story. And then I'll ask you, do you think it clarifies and sheds light on our story? So keep in mind, text 4 on page 33 is going to help explain our seaside escapade between Benjamin and Judah. Sindrine. Wait, sorry, did you read?
Yeah, I read.
You read, Sindrine.
Wake me at sunrise, and then told his older son, wake me at 3 hours after sunrise. The younger son came to awaken the king at sunrise, and the older son prevented him from doing so, explaining, Father told me to wake him in 3 hours from now. But the younger son insisted, Father told me to wake him now at sunrise. As they were arguing, their father woke and said to them, My children, you both only intended to honor me by your actions, so I will bestow each of you with a reward. The parable relates to the story at the sea. What reward did the tribe of Benjamin receive for entering the sea first? The divine presence dwelt in their territory when the holy temple was built. What reward did the tribe of Judah receive? A merited kingship.
Okay, so here we have a parable. Parables should help, right? So what's the parable? Yeah, I don't think it's going to help, but let's go through it. Well, ultimately, it's going to help, but we've got some questions right now. So let's explore. Can you pass down, Jillian, can you pass down a copy, Sandrine, to Jillian? Thank you. Okay, so let's explore this parable. Before we ask any questions, let's understand this story. So you have a king. Is it a king or a father? Is it a king? It's a king. Okay, he has two sons.
He's a father.
A king and a father. Same guy. Tells the younger son, wake me at sunrise. Wake me at sunrise. And the next one, the older son, he says, wake me 3 hours after sunrise. And each one he speaks to privately.
What was the reason for
father? Well, there's a lot of questions. One second. So then, at sunrise, the younger son, very obediently, goes over to the father and is about to wake him up. And the older son says, what are you doing? I'm waking him up. No, you aren't. He told me to wake him up at dawn, at sunrise. No, he told me to wake him up 3 hours after sunrise. They're arguing. In the meantime, the king wakes up and he says, oh, you both love me. You both intended to wake me up. You both had good intentions. Therefore, I'll reward you both. So too, the Tosfot says, Benjamin and Judah both wish to honor God. Both, therefore, receive reward. One gets the temple and one gets the monarchy, the kingship. Make sense?
What is a good intention of Judah? Yes.
Right. Well, so there's a lot of questions. Let's talk about the story itself. First of all, right, what's the deal with the king? Seriously, can you make up your mind here? Why is he telling one son sunrise and the other one 3 hours after sunrise?
Snooze.
Yeah, I get that, but like, I guess we've all set alarms like, 6:30, 6:45, 7, 7:15, just to hedge our bets. But what's going on here, right? What's the deal? You tell one son sunrise and the other one 3 hours after sunrise.
But is the 3 hours after sunrise, or is it 3 hours meaning that 3 hours would be up after the sunrise? There's a difference.
No. It's 3 hours post sunrise, like 6 a.m. or 9 a.m.
Okay.
Yeah, no, legit. Okay. So that, what's he doing? What's he driving his kids crazy? That, second of all, how does the parable connect with how does it connect with what we're trying to compare it to? When God said go into the sea, did he give two commands or one command? You with me? There's a difference here. In the story of Tosfot, the father, the king, gives two different commands, so there's therefore a confusion. When it came to God saying, right, we quoted it from inside. This is Torah. God says, keep on moving. How many commands are there? There's one command. So how do you have two tribes fighting over this? What's the fight anyway? God says travel, it's travel. Benjamin sounds like he's doing the right thing. God never said to Benjamin, jump in, and to Judah, make sure they don't by throwing stones at them. That didn't happen, right? Or wait 3 hours, and if you see anyone going in, here's some stones. That didn't happen. So what kind of parable is this? What kind of analogy is this? Right? A lot of the story doesn't make sense here. In other words, it doesn't seem to relate to what we're trying to compare it to. Okay. So in order to explain all of this, and there are many more questions on this that I didn't ask because we've had enough questions for tonight. Maybe we'll throw in some more, but let's start getting to some explanations. You see, the commentaries on the commentary of Tosfot, see, you have the Talmud. We have the Torah, the Talmud. And then you have Rashi and Tosfot as a commentary on the Talmud. But then you have sub-commentaries on Tosfot explaining what Tosfot is saying, because right now we have no idea what he's saying. So we need more layers of commentary. And then there's us here tonight. Right? It's like after all is said and done. We're the latest in this whole chapter. Okay. So the commentaries on Tosfot say that what he's referring to with this whole example of a king and the two sons and wake me up at sunrise and 3 hours after sunrise, it all relates to another Mishnah. Ooh, it's like a story and a story and a story. It relates to another Mishnah, another teaching, regarding the obligation, the mitzvah, to recite the Shema in the morning. Now, let's take a step back. Most famous prayer, Jewish prayer, is known as the Shema. It's got an opening line. It's got a second line that we recite quietly because we ripped it off the angels, but that's another story. Then it's followed by three paragraphs, the first of which is the most well-known, and it fits that perfect attention span to be able to sing it and not be go on too long in the synagogue. So that's why we only sing the first paragraph, even though there are three paragraphs. But the first one is sung, and that's what people pretty much know by heart or whatever, by the tune. So that is the Shema. In the Shema, it says that you shall recite these words when you wake up and when you go to bed, which means that there's an obligation to recite the Shema prayer in the morning and at night, when you wake up and when you lie down, in the morning and at night. Comes along, that's all biblical. Comes along the Mishnah Talmud, comes along the Mishnah, and the Mishnah says, wait a second. You're telling me I need to say it in the morning. How long do I have? When's the starting point? And when's the end point? We have to have a start and an end time. It can't just be subjective, say it whenever you want. If you consider it morning, go for it. No, it has to have parameters. So when does the when's the earliest time you can say it? And when's the cutoff? What's my window? What's considered the morning, beginning, and what's considered the end? Text number 5. Steve.
From what time may one recite the Shema in the morning? From the time that one can distinguish between blue and white. Rabbi Elazar says, between blue and green, and he has time to finish until sunrise. Rabbi Yoshua says that one may recite the Shema from dawn until 3 hours after sunrise, because kings typically arise 3 hours after sunrise.
Okay, so let's understand this very, very quickly, the actual law regarding the Shema. So when can you start reciting the Shema? Now, it's known, if you've ever seen a sunrise, you know that the first, it's dark, right? And then you first see rays of light emerging over the horizon, right, from the east. Sunrise in the east, that's in the west. So in the east, you see the emergence, but it's still not bright. You just see some light coming in, but it's not super bright. So when can you start saying the Shema? When is it considered morning? So the first opinion says when it's light enough to see the difference between, to tell the difference between blue and white. The second one says, no, it's got to be even brighter, between blue and green. Imagine being able to distinguish between shades that are kind of close to each other, so it has to be even brighter to be able to distinguish between those two shades. Another one says that, and what's the ending time? Until sunrise, when the sun is all the way up. Okay? Or when it's up enough that it's bright outside. Rabbi Yeshua says, and let's focus on this opinion, Rabbi Yeshua says, you can say it from dawn, that's your start time is dawn, until 3 hours after sunrise, and this is the accepted opinion, this latter opinion of Rabbi Yeshua. So you have from dawn until 3 hours after sunrise. That's your window to say the Shema every single morning. And by the way, depending on the day, those times change, because every day, sunrise is a few minutes earlier or later, depending on the time of year. I have on my phone, and I don't want to get to it right now, because look at this, I have my streaming app, just so you all know what's going on here. This is a camera, the red light's on. Anyway, getting back. So on my phone, I have an app called Zmanim. Zmanim in Hebrew means times. My Zmanim app, I do that sound also. No, I hit the Zmanim app, and boom, it immediately locks into where I am, the exact longitude and latitude, and it tells me exactly when sunrise is, when's the earliest time for Shema, the earliest time for Talis and Tefillin, the earliest time to say the Shema and Esrei, the Amida, the earliest time, the last time for the Shema, the last time for the Amida, the earliest time for Mincha, etc. It gives you all the times that you need to know throughout the day. Yeah, well, I don't travel that much, but I mean, at least, you know, between here and New York, it works. And in New Orleans, I was just there and it works. Not lately, not since I got the app. Anyway, so here's the point. So the point is that's the accepted time, from dawn until 3 hours after sunrise. But why 3 hours after sunrise? This is the kicker. Why? Because kings typically arise 3 hours after sunrise. Let's explain. Let's say sunrise is 6 a.m. Okay? When's a king rolling out of bed? According to this?
9
a.m. Why? Here's why. Because he's the king. You don't have to do much when you're the king. No. Well, I don't know. Maybe I've never been a king. But here's what it says in the commentaries. Because the king has workers in the palace. And the workers get up early. And they're starting to work from dawn. Remember, we have to also explain. Back in the day, you didn't have electricity. And so at night, you kind of weren't working. I mean, you could theoretically burn candles and whatever. But have you ever tried to see at night with candlelight? Have you ever tried? It's hard. Have you ever checked your chametz on the night of Passover, the night before Passover, the night before the eve of Passover, with a candle? You know what's weird? It's amazing. When you hold a candle in front of you or a torch, it's like a lot of light. It's like very, it's very bright and it's very dark at the same time. It's very strange. It illuminates only in immediate surroundings, but it doesn't really cast like a usable light. It's very much focused on that individual space. Have you ever? It wouldn't. Oh, it would, because you would focus on. Oh, you wouldn't, right? Well, there's a reason why we check the chametz by the light of a candle, even with electricity. It's because when you're doing it like that, you're really locked into to an individual space. You're not glossing over a large space. You're really space by space. It's very cool. Anyway, in the palace, so you have the workers, the palace officials. They're getting up at dawn, at daybreak, and starting to work. The king. It's only right and honorable that he should wake up after all the work is done, after the palace is ready for the king. So he rolls out 3 hours later to give everyone enough time. That's what the commentary is saying. So getting back to Tosfot's parable, the king tells his two sons. He tells one son, wake me up at sunrise. He tells the other one, wake me up 3 hours after sunrise. How many commandments did he give? One. Why? When he told the younger son, sunrise, what did he mean? My sunrise. And my sunrise is 3 hours after sunrise. Are you with me? Are you with me on this? Right. Kings get up 3 hours after sunrise. So he tells his younger son, wake me up at sunrise. He doesn't mean at 6 a.m. Which king is getting up at 6 a.m.? It's unheard of. What does he need to do at 6 a.m.? Watch all the workers troll through the palace? He doesn't need to do that. So he tells his younger son, sunrise. But what does he mean? 3 hours after sunrise. The older son, he tells the same thing. He basically said, you know what he said? Wake me up in the morning. So the younger son says here, sunrise. The older son, because he's older and more mature, and he knows his father, and he knows what kings do. The older son knows that he means, what? 3 hours after sunrise. Comes the next morning. The younger son, the son who doesn't have the wisdom, a little immature, but immature, that doesn't have the knowledge of what it means to be a king. He hears his father says, sunrise, wake me up first thing in the morning. Let's say first thing in the morning. First thing in the morning. He says, first thing in the morning, sunrise. What does the older son say? This is not when dad gets up. This is not when kings get up. This is not first thing in the morning for a king. Your dad is, our father is royalty. 3 hours. He says, no. He said first thing in the morning. 3 hours, first thing in the morning. They're arguing. The father wakes up and he says, you know what? I love you both. Right? For the younger son. The younger son has good intentions. The younger son means well. The younger son heard first thing in the morning, so it's first thing in the morning. The older son has the maturity and the wisdom and the insight to know that first thing in the morning for a king is 3 hours. But they both meant well. And therefore he rewards them both. Make sense? How many commands did he give to his sons? One. Although Tosfot says he told one sunrise and the other one 3 hours after sunrise, in between the lines he told both sons the same thing. First thing in the morning, the younger son heard sunrise. The older son heard 3 hours later, because that's when malachim, that's when kings get up. And therefore both are rewarded. So what happens now by Benjamin and Judah? You guys ready to get back to that story? Okay, go. Because he has to wake up a little bit before. Wake up like 3 hours after sunrise, minus 90 seconds. Give him 90 seconds to...
They have clocks anyways.
They didn't have clocks. Right, it's all... Right, they didn't have apps. Yeah, they had a sundial. How accurate is a sundial already? Well, give or take 3 hours, right? Seriously. All right. It's a good question, but it means until when royalty gets up. So royalty would have to get up a little bit earlier. But here's the point. In Tosfot's parable, the king said one command to both sons. Wake me up in the morning first thing. The younger son heard sunrise. The older son heard 3 hours later. They both had good intentions. They're both rewarded. Let's get back to the sea. God says, Vayiso, jump in. Listen to this. Benjamin, who was one of the younger tribes, one of the younger sons of Jacob originally, Benjamin, the little one, Benjamin, the younger son, says, Dad said, jump in. We're jumping in. Judah is an older, more mature, wiser tribe. And Judah says, what are you doing? What are you doing? If you jump in now, before the sea is split, you know what it's going to look like? If we all jump in now to the sea, before it's split, you know what it will appear? It's going to look like mass suicide. It's going to look like we didn't believe in God to the Egyptians that are behind us. It's going to look like we gave up hope and we gave up our lives. And even if a miracle happens, it's going to look like a fluke or an accident or God is bailing us out, but it looks like we messed up. Judah says, wait until the sea splits. Let God's miracle happen and then we'll walk through. So Benjamin says, Dad said, go in, let's go in. Wake me up at sunrise, it's sunrise. And Judah says, you have to know how to interpret these things. You have to have a little wisdom to know what it means. Sunrise is not sunrise for a king. It's 3 hours later. And when God says go, he doesn't mean go this second. He means let's split the sea. He'll split the sea, and then we'll go. You understand? Why the stones? So Benjamin certainly thought, the tribe of Benjamin certainly thought they were doing the right thing. God said travel. So they traveled. What could be wrong with traveling? If God says travel, we're going. We're marching forth. Judah also had good intentions. Judah says, that's not what God meant. We know what God means. God means wait for the miracle and then go through. Otherwise, it's going to look like we didn't have hope and we didn't have faith in God. And in fact, listen to this. If we all go into the water, into the sea before it splits, Judah argued, the tribe of Judah argued, it's going to desecrate God's name. It's going to indicate that we had no faith as a people in God's ability, and that's going to besmirch, it's going to cast a negative light on our relationship with God. Look, God's people didn't have faith in God. They looked at God as unable to save them, so they threw themselves to their death into the sea, even if it ultimately would split later. This is before it split, mind you. Judah says, you're running into the sea like a bunch of, like a mass suicide mission here. You're desecrating God's name. Chilul Hashem, desecration of God's name. You know what punishment is for Chilul Hashem? We're going to throw stones. They did it. Because they believed that Benjamin was doing something wrong. But they both had positive intentions. Benjamin heard go and they said, let's go. And Judah heard go and they heard go after the miracle happens. To make a Kiddush Hashem, to sanctify God's name. Does this make sense?
But I have a question.
Yeah.
So I was thinking that the reason that it would desecrate God's name by going in before the miracle is that it could be interpreted that it was in other words, because you've got a bunch of people that worship false gods, and it could be interpreted as if the Israelites caused it, not God caused it. In other words,
right. You're saying they were the ones that somehow brought it about as opposed to God because of them going in.
Because remember, you've got right. You know, a people around them
right.
That
right, and sorcerers and black magic and all that stuff, right?
Exactly, and so you know that it would look as if it was sorcery or magic,
right?
You know, an idol.
That's it could be the commentators say that. Definitely, certainly, what I'm mentioning is mentioned by the commentators. Could be that's another angle in there. I think they kind of both fit. Either way, Benjamin felt they were young and energetic, and God says, go, God says, jump, we're jumping in. And Judah says, let's understand what's going on here. Let's look at the whole picture. Maybe God doesn't want us to jump in right now. Maybe we have to wait until the path is paved, and then we jump in.
I have another question, too, that I had before, and that's what the question is, the order. So we read first Tosafot, the parable, right?
Yes.
But interestingly enough, it's the Talmud, Rahot, that actually answers the question of the parable that came 1,000 years later.
Well, the Tosafot and the Talmud is about 500-600 years.
Difference.
Yeah.
Okay, Tosafot is when it's okay, so
they're like the 1200s.
Okay. All right.
So and the Talmud is like 500-600. So it's
seem like
well, here's the thing. Tosafot in the analogy had in mind that teaching of the Mishnah.
Okay. All right.
That's what it means. In other words, the Mishnah is not explaining Tosafot. The Mishnah is giving us an understanding of what Tosafot's intention was with that parable.
Okay.
Tosafot gives a parable.
Do you understand my question?
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah. No, the Tosafot gives an example of a king and two sons and a directive to wake him up at either sunrise or 3 hours after. To understand the depth of what Tosafot is saying, you have to know the Mishnah that Tosafot certainly knew. Once you know the Mishnah, now Tosafot makes sense in the parable. And also in the analog, in our case with Benjamin and Judah.
But now...
Yeah. It's like this is like the explanation that comes at chronologically out of order. Be that as it may, here's what happens. Both in the parable and in the real life story of the splitting of the sea, there was only one directive given. The king said, "Wake me up in the morning, first thing," and God said, "Go into the sea." In both cases, it's open for interpretation. How early is first thing in the morning? And when do you want me to go into the sea? Now or soon? In both cases, the younger one is the more
literal
and the more energetic and the more gung-ho and the more, let's do it. That's it. Forget about it. It's happening. Right? And the older one says, wait a second. Let's understand this. Does this make sense? Right? Let's process it. Let's figure it out. What's the best way? What's the right way? What's the intention? And then we'll act. We're not just going to jump into things.
Seems kind of tricky. Like,
the whole explanation.
Well, I mean, just like why wouldn't the message be more clear?
Well, you know, sometimes it's fun to keep things ambiguous because then you have many different interpretations, right? I don't know.
But the question is, like, God gave direction, command to Moses, not to Benjamin and not to Judah.
But somehow he leaked it to everybody. He's like, wait,
yeah.
Hold on, my earpiece. God is saying.
Yeah, why not, if it's leader, like, selected by God, they should come to leader, right?
Right.
Why is it?
God says travel. Moses says God said travel. Benjamin jumps in. And Judah says don't jump in. You're desecrating God's name. You're jumping in. It looks like you're committing suicide.
It's like reading between the lines.
It's reading between the lines. I'll tell you, you know, in life, in my experience, I have some of the same questions. Like, how, you know, you look back, it's like, couldn't they have been a little bit more clear? And then you realize, like, even documents that are a few hundred years old, you have documents of our nation. And you have amendments that speak about the right to bear arms and other things, and like it's disputed to this very day in the courts, in the public. What's the intention? What, they couldn't have written a little bit more clearly? You couldn't have written a few more lines? And how many times have you had a conversation with somebody and they walk away and they have a different impression of what you said? Like today or yesterday or last week? Well, why couldn't we be a little bit more clear? And if you say it's a human failing, but certainly God could have made it more clear, I don't know. So that I don't know. When you pull the God card, if we pull the God card, God could have, you know, who knows, right? It's all God's. But the reality is that communication is filled with interpretation and different nuances of understanding. I would venture to say that out of tonight's class, every one of you has a bit of a different understanding of what I'm trying to say. In other words, I have an understanding of what I feel like this class is saying, but I would bet that each of you has a slightly different understanding of what I mean. And here's the question. If I mean it, why can't they just share it? I'm trying, but it's not that. It's everyone hears things a little bit different. And it's diversity, and it's actually celebrated by God. The one God created many things. God didn't just want oneness. He didn't have to do anything to have oneness. He just was one. God wanted diversity, and diversity includes diversity of thought, and diversity of opinion, and diversity of perspective. And so God says, go! And the younger tribe says, let's do it. And the older tribe says, wait a second. Slow down. My back. No, they didn't say my back. They said, slow down. You're desecrating God's name. And by the way, remember when Rashi said that they threw the stones because they were jealous? No rhymes with jealous.
Zealous.
Such a terrible segue. Who does that? So the Hebrew word that we translated before as jealous, like envy, can also be translated from the Hebrew as zealous. And what is zealotry? It means standing up for something you believe in. And in this case, Judah was acting not out of jealousy, but out of zealotry. And Judah was feeling that Benjamin was desecrating God's name and besmirching the Jewish people. And so Judah says, how dare you, Benjamin? I love you like a brother. But here's some pebbles. Yeah. And so they threw some stones. And God says, my younger son, the younger tribe of Benjamin, they love me. They're willing to throw themselves into the sea. Wherever I go, I want them to be my home. I want them to build my my vacation home. It's got so much energy. Build the house. House the temple, baby, in Israel. That's where I'm going to stay. I'm going to stay by Benjamin. Wild card. No, stay by Benjamin. And Judah, who has the maturity and the vision and sees the big picture, that's what you need in a king. In a leader, you need someone who not only acts by impulse, but someone who sees the big picture. When God says, go into the water, travel, keep on moving, Judah says, what does God really mean? He's not impulsive. Right? When the king says, wake me up at sunrise, the Judah son says, I know what dad wants, 3 hours in. He reads between the lines. He has that seichel, he has that wisdom, that understanding to know what the real intention is. That's what you need in a leader. A leader has to have the quality of not being impulsive, but being thought out, methodical, and correct. And so the kingdom goes to Judah, and the home for God goes to Benjamin. So what does it mean for us? I started the class by saying, parenthetically, that I would venture to say that many of you have not heard of this whole story, this whole episode of Benjamin and Judah. I think I might have been right, right? It's a fascinating story. And especially with this explanation, it's like, wow. But what does it mean for us? We can walk out tonight and say, oh, interesting. So back in the day, 3,300 years ago, there was a little bit of a dispute between Benjamin and Judah threw stones, and they each got rewarded, and they lived happily ever after, or whatever. But what does it mean for us? In life, there are two qualities. There are more, but let's focus on these two. There are two qualities for a human being. One is acting decisively and quickly and taking action. Action. So there's a need, we jump on it. So we hear about something, a cause, a person in distress, whatever it is, we say, I'm there to help. Taking action. Is that a good thing? 100%. Whose quality is that? Be a Benjamin. Be a Benjamin. When the need comes, when the need arises, when there's a cause, or when something's there that needs your help, jump in. When there's a mission that comes your way, take it. When you get inspired, jump on it. Don't push it off. Don't think about it too much. Jump on the, seize the day, seize the moment. Carpe diem, baby. That is Benjamin. That's a quality. It's a human quality. It's a good thing to have. Be a Benjamin, but also be a Judah. You see, we've split them into two tribes, but hey, we can be two tribes, right? What's to say we can't be both? And what's the Judah quality? The Judah quality is study, perspective, maturity, right? Vision, understanding, right? This wisdom, the depth of knowing that broadens the perspective. So in a sense, these two qualities can be boiled down to mitzvah action and Torah study. When it comes to doing a mitzvah, jump on it. Seize the moment. You hear about a mitzvah. Somebody needs some help. So jump on it. Don't push it off. Don't let someone else do it. You do it. It's a worthy cause. Right? There's something that you need to do to improve your life spiritually. Jump on it. Don't push it off. What's one of my neighbors going to say? Do I really mean it? Don't think too much. Jump into it. That's the Benjamin perspective. That's the action mitzvah perspective. At the same time, a well-rounded human being has not only the action, but also the study. And so we're meant not just to do a mitzvah or to do mitzvot, but also to study the Torah. And studying the Torah gives us a broader perspective. And it gives us a wisdom and a depth and an understanding to know what it is that God truly wants and what it is that we are truly meant to do. And so I often joke that a well-rounded Jew is someone who has a chip on both of their shoulders. But tonight, we're going to modify the definition. Just for tonight. My joke still stands. But for tonight, we're going to modify the definition and say that what is a well-rounded human being? Someone who possesses the ability to act and act quickly, but also the ability to think and to ponder deeply and to act in a responsible fashion. Mitzvah and Torah. Can't beat the combination. Thank you for joining me tonight for Torah Studies.